Kristen Weller was a 12-year-old girl who lived in Surrey, British Columbia. She had a bit of a rough childhood and was known to be a runaway, especially when her parents were fighting and drinking. But they had split now, and Weller was living with her father and grandmother at a motel where they were working towards moving into an apartment. On November 17, 1980, Weller was pulling her bike alongside her father, who was going to a bar. He had just turned 47 a few days back and was looking to celebrate. While walking, her dad asked where she got the bike, and she replied by saying her friend lent it to her. Once they got there, both of them said their goodbyes, and her father told her to go straight home. On her way home, Weller was stopped by a man yelling from the animal hospital parking lot, asking where the unemployment office was. Weller rode over and the two of them got to talking. The last time she was seen was around 10 p.m. by a security guard. She was sitting in the front seat of a car, and the security guard said she looked drunk or drugged, but the man who was with her said that it was okay, that she was his niece. So the security guard kept moving. She didn't come home that day, but her family assumed she was with a friend, and when no one heard from her 2 days later, they reported her a runaway. A month later, on Christmas Day, a man was taking a walk and saw something in a blackberry bush. At first, he thought it was a mannequin, but when he got closer, he realized it was a body. He got into his car and flagged down the first police vehicle he saw. It was indeed the body of 12-year-old Christina Weller. She was left nude with traces of alcohol and drugs in her system and had been strangled and stabbed multiple times. A full investigation commenced, the police releasing Weller's description, asking anyone with information to come forward. The police also asked for help finding her friend's bike. It was found behind the animal hospital where Weller disappeared, confirming it was probably her last location alive. Welcome to the final episode of Canadian Killers. This podcast will go over the crimes, investigation, and trial of known Canadian serial killers. Before we get started, I must mention this podcast will contain topics of substance abuse, violence, sexual assault, and use explicit language. It is not suitable for younger audiences. Clifford Olson was born January 1st in 1940 in downtown Vancouver. His father was in the Canadian Armed Forces during World War II. Because his father was in the military, Olson didn't get disciplined much at home. Olson was also sexually assaulted by his uncle at a young age. He played it off as a game, having him take off all his clothes before lying on top of him. He was a handful at school and was known to lie to keep himself out of trouble or just make himself look better. At the age of 10, Olson flashed a knife at a little girl and forced her into a bush so he could grope her. Around this time, he began skipping class and stealing. He also started selling newspapers at a racetrack and dropped out of school in 1956, starting to work at the racetrack more often. Between 1956 and 1981, Olson had been arrested 94 times, with a long criminal history involving things like fraud, armed robbery, and sexual assault. But just putting him in prison didn't stop his heinous crimes. In 1959, he walked into two prisoners raping a 16-year-old inmate, and instead of helping the young boy in, he joined in with the other two prisoners. Between 1957 and 1968, Olson escaped prison seven times. In the spring of 1961, he was arrested for robbery, went to prison, but a month in, he managed to climb the prison fence and escape. He was later caught in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. Now, because Olson was involved in a lot of prison rapes and violence, he rarely got parole until 1972, where he got a chance at parole, but it was revoked when he was caught with stolen goods. At the same time, Olson admitted to molesting children and was moved to the Supermax unit. There he met child killer Gary France Marcoux. Olson then befriended him and went on to testify against him in court, helping the police obtain a conviction for child murder. In relation, Olson was released from prison in 1980. That year, Olson met Jonah Hale and had a son. The two of them would live in Surrey, British Columbia, and that's when the Reign of Terror began. Police were stumped by the murder of Weller, but the furthest thing on their mind was that a predator was on the loose, and that Weller was just the beginning. April 16, 1981, Colleen Marie Dignot, 13 years old, was skateboarding to a bus stop to go to a friend's. Olson pulled up beside the bus stop, asking where the unemployment office was, saying he was looking to hire kids to wash windows for $10 an hour. Dignot was seen getting into the car with him, and that was it. She was reported missing, but the police thought it was another runaway case and decided to treat it as a low priority. April 21st, 1981, 16-year-old Darian Todd Johnstrund was visiting his mother and her new husband from Saskatchewan. He had only been in town for 2 days. While he was on the way to the store to buy cigarettes, Olson pulled up next to him and they began to chat. Olson offered him a job for $10 an hour and some beer. He got into the car and drove off. When Johnstrund didn't come home, his mother and stepfather began to get worried and called police, reporting him a missing person. A week later, his body was found in the forest by two men who had gone running with their dogs. He was found naked and slumped over a stump. He had been beaten to death with a hammer, along with there was evidence of him being drugged and sexually assaulted. While all of this was going on, Olson was getting ready to marry the mother of his son. But this didn't stop his crime spree. On the day of his wedding day, it was reported that he molested a 7-year-old girl. But his taste for blood began to grow again. Only 2 days after his wedding, he began looking for his next victim. Sandra Wolfstein was off to visit her boyfriend for lunch, but first decided to visit his mother. The two of them chatted, and off she went hitchhiking to the body shop where her boyfriend worked. His mother saw her get into a medium gray car with a man driving. When she was late for lunch, her boyfriend had thought she blew him off, but only after speaking with his mother, he knew something was wrong. He called the police, but was told he had to wait 48 hours before filling a missing persons report. Wolfstein was never seen again. The bloodshed continued. On June 21, 1981, 13-year-old Ada Anita Court was done babysitting for her brother and sister-in-law and was making her way to her boyfriend's house. She was picked up by Olson and the two drank beer, with Olson promising to get her more. She vanished after that. However, at 8 p.m. that night, a man who was out driving at Weaver Lake saw a man beside a black pickup truck with a girl in a multicolored sweater bent over. She wasn't moving. Thinking that they needed help, he got out his car and asked. Olson just stared at the man with a blank face, not responding to the question. Frightened, the man went back into his car and drove off. Olson tried following him, but he was able to lose him. He did not report the incident to the police until everything else came to light, and he realized what he had likely seen that night. On July 2, 1981, 9-year-old Simon Partington was riding his bike to a friend's place. He never arrived. He was then reported missing after he didn't do his paper route. A massive search began with 200 people volunteering, but no one was able to find him. People began thinking these cases may be connected, but Olson remained unfazed. The next day after the Partington abduction, Olson approached 16-year-old Sandra Docker and Rosa Smith at an arcade. He offered them both jobs cleaning carpets for a construction crew. The girls agreed. They got into the car and they threw and drank beer to celebrate before Olsen dropped them back off at a mall, making plans to reconnect with them the next Monday. On July 6, he picked them up at the mall and said he wanted to get coffee and drove them to Nuffy's Donuts. While there, Olsen informed them that the construction crew only had enough work for the one of them and picked Docker. The two of them drove off, making a stop at an apartment where he gave her a bottle of whiskey, and then at a photo store and then a dealership where he exchanged his Pinto for a green Grata. Docker noted that as he drank, he became more irritable and began getting frustrated with her when she didn't want to drink anymore. Getting scared of him, she forced herself to drink more to the point she was feeling sick. He drove them to a secluded location and parked the car, getting in the back seat with her, trying to sexually assault her. She fought and resisted, and eventually Olsen gave up, slurring out, "You're fired," before driving her back to the mall. When they got back, Docker flagged down an RCMP officer, telling him that the man in the green car tried to rape me. Olsen was then picked up, but wouldn't talk about what he was accused of unless to deny or claim she was into it. He also made the bold statement of telling police that he helped them get a child rapist, being a jailhouse snitch, so they owed him. Since there was no witnesses and Docker was drunk, the Crown didn't feel comfortable pressing charges, so they charged him with drunk driving instead, and Olsen was let go. This would prove to be a fatal mistake, because on July 9th, 1981, a day later, Olsen would kill again. This time, Olsen was driving around with an 18-year-old boy. The 18-year-old says the two of them were hanging out when they saw 14-year-old Judy Cosma. He claims that Cosma must have known him because she waved before coming over. She said she was on her way to a job interview in Richmond and Olsen offered her a drive. The three of them arrived in Richmond early, so they decided to kill time by driving around and drinking beer. Olsen took this opportunity to tell Cosma she didn't need the job interview, that he could get her a job cleaning carpets. Cosma said she didn't know and would think about it. He kept giving her drinks, but she didn't want to be drunk for the interview, so he gave her a pill that was supposedly going to stop her from getting drunk. They went to his apartment, but Cosma was scared she was going to miss her job interview, so they went back and dropped the 18-year-old off at the mall, and he said he was taking Cosma to the job interview. She disappeared after that. The next day, Olsen took his family to the Knott's Berry Farm theme park in L.A. During his vacation, the police met up to discuss the missing children. Olsen was brought up during the conversation because of his previous crimes, but there was some doubt in his involvement. The RCMP, though, did think it was a good idea to keep an eye on him. 2 days after Olsen came back from his vacation, he returned to his killing spree, taking the lives of four more children within a 7-day time period. Not knowing what he had been doing, the police approached Olsen, wanting to know if he could give them any information, specifically any information about Simon Partington. Olsen said he would have to think about it, but shared his theories of what could have happened to Partington. The police decided to put Olsen on surveillance, as they found him to be suspicious. On January 25th, Sigrid Art, 18 years old, was visiting Canada from Germany with a large group. That day, the rest of the group went on a day cruise, but she went to visit her cousin. When she arrived at her cousin's home, she realized she wasn't there and decided to take the bus back to the hostel she was staying at. That's when Olsen pulled up next to her. He offered her a ride back and then invited her to drink with him at a local pub. She agreed. After they finished drinking, he said he would drive her back after showing her around. He handed her a beer that was drugged. He took her to the peat bogs near Richmond. Ard said she was feeling sick, so Olden handed her another pill that he said was meds. They took a stroll along the river, and when they got near the train tracks, Olson unexpectedly brought a hammer down on her head. While he was undressing her, he heard the sound of a train whistle. The brakeman saw the two but thought it was a couple having consensual sex, and Ard was fading in and out of consciousness, so she couldn't fight back or wave for help. Olson waved at the brakeman, and the train moved along. He then finished raping Ard, then beating her to death with a hammer. On July 1981, the RCMP was getting ready to set up surveillance on Olson, but sadly, they were a few hours too late. Olson went on the hunt early that morning, running into 15-year-old Terry Carson, who was on her way to apply to a job at a local pet shop. He pulled over and offered her a ride, then a job. When she accepted, he handed her a lace beer to celebrate. He then drove 2 hours to Hope City to cash travel checks he'd stolen from Ard, signing them Robert Johnson. Driving back, he pulled over into a logging road where he brutally raped Terry while hammering a screw into her head. After he was done, he realized she was still alive, so he dragged her to a ditch with water and stood on her back until she drowned. The RCMP finished setting up surveillance on Olson's house as his car pulled up, being freshly through the car wash. Olson must have figured out he was being followed, as he would often try to lose the police's grasp, and it worked. Eventually, the police gave up and decided they would return when they were more organized. On July 29th, Olson was arrested after him and a couple other men picked up two teenage girls and got them drunk. He was released without any charges. On his way to see his lawyer, he ran into Louise Chartrand, age 17. She had hitchhiked to work that day and was early, so she decided she'd pick up some cigarettes. Olson pulled up next to her, where she was smoking, and offered her a job. She got in the car, and he proceeded to give her alcohol and pills, and then drove them to a secluded gravel pit. There, he tied her up and raped her. And when she was getting out of the car to use the bathroom, he hit her in the head with a hammer. Still alive, he pushed her into a depression in the ground and covered her with rocks and gravel until he couldn't see her anymore. Then he washed his hand with the alcohol and left. He went and got his car washed at a garage and then made it home around 6 a.m., where he told his wife to pack and that they were moving to Alberta because the cops were trying to frame him for something. Eventually, he returned. And that same week, the body of another young woman was found, and Olson was put on 24-hour surveillance. It was tough following him because he was never driving the same car for too long, but they did manage to witness him committing some crimes like robbery and fraud. But it wasn't enough. They needed to ensure they could put Olson away for a very long time. And on August 12th, it happened. Olson took the ferry to Victoria, Vancouver Islands, where he robbed houses. When he drove off, he stopped to pick up two girls who were hitchhiking, and then pulled over to a secluded spot in the woods. Police couldn't let this go any further, so they closed in. Olson had only stopped to use the bathroom, but once he saw police, he bolted. After a quick chase, Olson was detained and was denying all allegations. But a notebook was found, and in it was Jody Comasina's name. They were finally able to link Olson with one of the murders. Olson was then arrested on two charges of breaking and entering. Once in interrogation, Olson said he wanted to make sure he could take care of his wife and son. So for $100,000, he would show them where the bodies could be found. $10,000 per body. The RCMP took him up on the offer as they wanted to ensure that the families could finally have their closure. Olson began talking and gave up all the locations of the bodies. He also had a psychiatric exam done and was found fit to stand trial. In January 1982, Olson pled guilty to all 11 counts of murders in the first degree and was given 11 life sentences. He spent time in Supermax before he was sent to the Special Handling Unit. There, he sent some graphic letters to the families of his victims detailing his crimes. When applying for parole, Olson decided to represent himself. All four character witnesses he called to the stand said he shouldn't be released. Even worse, in his concluding statement, Olson said, "Ladies and gentlemen, you see me before you. Do I look like a raving lunatic?" The jury was able to keep their composure, but the victim's family members broke out into a fit of laughter. Within 15 minutes, the jury decided to deny him of parole. Olson has gone on the record saying he committed crime because there was nothing else to do, and that he didn't want his victims' parents to find out he was sexually assaulting them, so he killed them. In September 2011, Olson was diagnosed with terminal cancer and was transferred to a hospital in Quebec. He died on September 30th, 2011, at the age of 71, permanently ending his thirst for young blood. The information for this podcast was found in court transcripts and Canadian news coverage of the events of Clifford Olson.